Welcome to the Nursing and Midwifery Emporium podcast, a podcast about this nursing life. I'm Nicole Nash-Arnold from Nurse Manager HQ.
And I'm Sue Walker from the Nursing CPD Institute. And together each week, we seek out interesting people to discover what a red-hot nursing life looks like.
Hello. Today I welcome to the This Nursing Life microphone Tony Hoffman. You might recognise that name. Tony was the nurse unit manager of the intensive care unit at Bundaberg Hospital in 2005 and was launched into the media spotlight when she raised safety concerns regarding the director of surgery at the time. Tony had raised her concerns with hospital management, but they had fallen on deaf ears. She made the decision to become a whistleblower based on the ethical dilemma she found herself in regarding patient safety. Tony, welcome to the microphone.
Oh, thank you, Sue. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Now, Tony, we can't talk about ethics and patient safety without discussing the issues that pushed you into the media spotlight. What was happening that caused you to have to choose to become a whistleblower in 2005?
Well, what had happened was that a surgeon had been appointed at the Bundaberg Base Hospital, and pretty soon after he arrived, it became very apparent that things weren't right. For instance, one of the first patients that we got from theatre that had had an esophagectomy came through to ICU brain dead, and he was saying that the patient was stable. And the whole sort of thought processes of this doctor and the behaviour of the doctor and the poor outcomes and complications that we were seeing with his patients really made the nursing staff worry. So I think the first complaint we put in to the Director of Medical Services was around 6 weeks after he started, and that was after the patient arrived back from theatre brain dead. And for 2 years, there was a litany, really, of complaints from doctors, nurses and patients that went to the executive, and they continued to support Dr. Patel to the point where we'd seen many deaths. I had done an audit of patients that had died in the ICU, and there were 14 deaths, none of which had been reported to the coroner. And the executive just decided very early on that it was easier to discredit me than to deal with Dr. Patel. So we kept trying to get some response from the executive. We wanted some sort of independent audit done of his practices, and we fought really hard for that. A young boy lost his leg because of Dr. Patel's ineptitude, and there were all sorts of things going on. And what happened was the executive offered him another 5-year contract and gave him employee of the month. So we knew that nothing was going to happen. Like, it became almost, you know, there was nothing funny about it, but we joked that what could we do to get attention paid to what was going on? Strip naked and hang from the tree outside Red Rooster. That's, you know, what we were saying. By the time I went to the media and to Rob Messenger, the MP, I'd spoken to, I think, 14 different people in Bundaberg, including the coroner, the police, the chief health officer for Queensland Health, and there was no alternative than to try and go public.
So, Tony, why do you think you had to make that decision? What was happening at the health service that prevented other doctors or other nurses making the call you did?
There were lots of things. This was back in 2005. Well, 2003 to 2005, he was the director of surgery. Most of the doctors there were on 457 visas, and they were really afraid. Dr. Patel had so much power in the hospital because surgery was the only thing that was bringing in money to the hospital, and it was the first time the hospital had been in on budget for many years. And the doctors were afraid that if they kicked up too much of a stink, they would lose their jobs. So there was a lot of fear associated with what was going on. Some doctors did try, and a couple of the doctors did come with me to see the Director of Medical Services. I guess the response from the executive was that this was all related to a personality conflict between myself and Dr. Patel.
So even though you and a group of doctors who were working with this person went to the higher administration of the organisation, it was still put down to a personality problem.
Yeah, And the director of nursing gave me a book to read on how to deal with difficult people that was written in like 1960. So it was just a perfect example of how easy it is to discredit a nurse versus a doctor. Politics in hospitals are very interesting things. I'd try and get an appointment with the director of nursing and her secretary wouldn't give me an appointment. You know, things like that. There was a lot of huge barriers put up. And, you know, Dr. Patel was very clever. He ingratiated himself, not just within the hospital, but within the community, in the places that were going to benefit him. Like he went to one of the local Jehovah's Witness meetings and told them that he was an expert in bloodless surgery. It so happened that a Jehovah's Witness patient did come into the hospital with a nicked carotid artery, and the person that was with him asked for Dr. Patel. And we had to lie and say Dr. Patel wasn't working that day.
The patient was seen by someone else.
Yes. Yeah. His doctor that was looking after him said to me, stay with that patient all day. Do not leave that patient's side. So basically I stayed with that patient all day and Dr. Patel had come in and look around and walk out again. And some of the doctors arranged to transfer any surgical patient to Brisbane medically so that they weren't seen by surgery at Bundaberg. So there was a lot of conspiring going on. I mean, there was a lot of people that knew that things weren't right, but there was lots of covering up going on all around the place. Very early on in the piece, Dr. Patel had a death when he was putting in a vas cath for a dialysis patient, and the renal department outsourced all of the vas cath insertions to another doctor at the Friendlies, and Patel didn't see another renal patient for that time.
They were trying to protect patients by using backdoor methods that they weren't exposed to this clinician.
Yeah, there were all sorts of things going on because the issue had been recognised, but everybody felt powerless to do anything about it.
Yeah.
And the people that had the power to do something about it decided that they weren't going to.
Right. Tony, your career has moved into academia.
Yes.
And you have lectured on the topic of nursing ethics for several years. Based on your experience and now your expert body of knowledge in the field, how do you define ethics?
Well, the general definition of ethics is that it concerns the moral principles that govern a person's behaviour or activity. In relation to healthcare, we refer to it as bioethics. And that's further broken down into the ethical principles such as autonomy, which is regarded as the overarching bioethical principle in Western medicine or Western culture, and the basis of things such as consent, the basis of pretty much all that we do within healthcare. And then we have beneficence, non-maleficence, veracity and justice. So I guess when you look at what happened with Patel, we had things like he falsified records in the patient's notes, so patients weren't giving informed consent. There certainly wasn't beneficence being carried out. And whilst I don't believe Patel was doing anything to, on purpose, to harm patients, he knew that he didn't have a license to practice, because we haven't got to that part yet, but he did not have a license to practice. He had relinquished his license to practice in the States prior to coming here because he was the most sued surgeon at Kaiser Permanente in the States. So the patients weren't consenting on an informed basis for surgery based on truthfulness or veracity. And of course, you know, justice comes into that. So all of the ethical principles pretty much were disregarded in what was going on.
So this clinician was not registered to practice medicine in Australia?
No. He had, I want to use a bad word and I know I can't, but he was so arrogant. He had on his license, the American license to practice, it said C stipulated order. And the stipulated order was that he had relinquished his license to practice to stop him from being sued. And the fact that his license had been revoked earlier, he wasn't allowed to perform any of the surgeries that he was performing at Bundaberg Base Hospital. But then he relinquished his license altogether. And that was said in the stipulated order. But nobody bothered to look at the stipulated order. Nobody knew what a stipulated order was. and nobody looked for it. So when he got off the plane in Brisbane and he went to the medical board and he showed them his document, nobody looked to see what this stipulated order meant. And then he rocks up here in Bundaberg, starts. He wasn't supposed to be the director of surgery. He was just supposed to be a surgeon. Within 2 weeks, they'd appointed him as director of surgery. And then it was free rein because he stopped all of the reporting mechanisms within the hospital. He didn't refer any deaths to the coroner. He did his own morbidity and mortality meetings. Yeah.
He met with himself.
Yeah. He met with himself and his junior doctors. Even some of the junior doctors tried really hard to raise issues because when all this was going on, he was sexually harassing the nursing staff and the young doctors, and they depended on him to write their references for them. So it was a very, very, very difficult situation.
So Tony, based on all of this then, do you believe that medical personnel, like, you know, doctors, nurses, allied health, come to the patient with a different ethical belief system than hospital management? Is that why things got so bad?
I think that they definitely do. I think when you're a bedside nurse, your focus is on the patient and your advocacy is for the patient. You do anything for that patient. You advocate for them to get to CT scan. You advocate for them to get the physio to see them. You focus very much on what that patient needs. Whereas the administrators and the executive, they're looking at all sorts of different things. They're looking at the budget. They're receiving income. They're looking at staff retention. So they knew that Patel was bringing in all this money, all this revenue. So their focus is on those things. They were more interested in thinking, oh, it's a personality conflict, you know, believing it was a personality conflict, than to actually look at what was happening. It was easy to look at what was happening. But, you know, if there were 8 beds in the ICU and 6 of them were filled with post-operative complications of the type that you don't ever see, you know that there's a problem. You don't need to do an audit for it. You know there's an issue. But for whatever reason, they decided to accept Patel's explanation for. We had a lot of issues with wound dehiscence, and I swear we used to have to go to a surgical meeting every month. And for 6 months, we argued at this meeting of what the definition of dehiscence was. That's how dysfunctional the hospital was. And he blamed the wound dehiscence on, he'd left the young doctors to suture. Then he blamed it on the suture material. And then people believed him.
Yeah. Tony, it was a horrendous time. As you rightfully say, the role of nurses, doctors, allied health, the role of everyone who works in the healthcare industry is advocacy and to get the best possible outcome they can. You had to make a difficult choice to be the whistleblower that brought this attention to the public sphere so that something could be done. What suggestions in hindsight would you provide colleagues regarding a situation if they found themselves in a heightened, a huge ethical dilemma?
I thought quite hard about this last night, and I thought one thing that would have made it a lot easier for me, I asked nearly every one of the other nurse unit managers in the other wards and that to come with me to see the executive, and nobody would come with me, and it ended up I had to go up by myself, and they made me sit outside, and you know, I was petrified, I was so scared, and they made me sit outside while they whispered and joked and laughed by themselves and kept me waiting for about 10 minutes, you know, for me to go in and tell them. And I went in and I said to them, if you guys don't do something about this, I'm going to take it elsewhere. I didn't know where elsewhere was at the time, but I was going to do something drastic. So what I would say to that is, as nurses, we have to support each other. We have to talk to each other. We have to talk to our managers. It just would have made things so much easier if I had had one or two people who backed what I was saying.
You also said that you escalated the complaint past local administration, like you actually went to the State Department.
Yeah, we went to the district manager, organised for the chief health officer to come up and do an investigation, but he refused to call it an investigation. He was a really nice man. He was really nice to us. I have no issue with him at all, but he wouldn't call it an investigation. He called it a fact-finding mission. And we knew just by the whole way that it was being dealt with that nothing was going to come from this.
Because the facts weren't presented or?
Well, we were relying on the notes, and the notes were falsified because Patel had written things that were untrue in the notes. When we got to the trial, because, of course, this went to three manslaughter trials. Where they got the evidence from was from the nurses' notes, because the nurses, like the nurses in ICU, they didn't lie in their notes, but Patel had lied in his notes.
And were they separate notes? Were they not an integrated?
Not in ICU. They would have been on the wards, but in the ICU we have a separate, you know, really involved flow sheet that we followed. I was the manager of the ICU, and I was very pedantic about documentation, and yep, that really helped the prosecution in the whole situation. Getting back to what we could do as nurses if you ever found yourself in a situation like that, usually in a hospital, someone, either a doctor or a nurse, if they don't have a qualification in ethics, someone will have an interest in it. So I would advise you to seek out that person. If they can't give you any advice, talk to the adult guardian and just see if there's anything that you can do with advice from them. What happened at Bundaberg can't happen anymore, because out of the Royal Commission, there were many recommendations that Queensland Health implemented. And one of them was that all healthcare-related deaths get reported to the coroner, and the coroner makes a decision about whether or not an inquest will be held, because there were 87 deaths associated with Patel's time in Bundaberg, and not one was referred to the coroner. So now that can't happen, and there were lots of other recommendations that came out. Now, when someone is appointed to a position, the person that's doing the recruitment has to Google them, the first 10 pages on Google, to make sure that there is no background information that is available, because all of this information was clearly available on Google about Patel's past. But remember, this is back in 2003. 2003 to 2005 it happened, and everybody wasn't so au fait with Googling and computers and that sort of thing. And I didn't even think that he wouldn't have had a license to practice. And it wasn't until a group of Hedley Thomas, who was the journalist who Googled him and found out his history. He came up, and a group of us had dinner here at my house. And one of the nurses that was here said, Patel can't just have become a bad surgeon overnight. He must have left a trail of destruction elsewhere. And Hedley went home and he couldn't sleep all night. And he just kept thinking about that. And he went back to Brisbane and he Googled him. And there it was, all in black and white, just sitting there, just waiting for someone to Google him. And so he rang me up, and it was about 11 o'clock at night, to tell me. And both Hedley and I, because we were very emotionally invested in the whole thing by then, were crying on the phone, because we were just thinking of all of those patients that had died and could have been prevented. It didn't have to happen.
Tony, based on your ongoing interaction with colleagues,
yeah,
do you believe that the health system is better, the same, or worse than your experience in 2005?
There's no doubt that it's better. There's a big focus on patient safety. There's still things that aren't right, but, you know, we're so lucky we live in Australia, really. I mean, you only have to look at how they've handled the COVID thing. It's no doubt better. You know, even just down to the fact that every healthcare-related death has to be reported to the coroner. Yeah. You know, that's a huge thing, and it's definitely better. And I think now people are more suspicious too. So if they got an inkling of something like what was happening, they might go to the 10th degree and find the information that they needed to find. I mean, it did not enter my head that he wouldn't have had a license to practice, because he was recruited through a recruiting firm in Sydney. You know, I thought that they would have done their checks and balances.
Due diligence, yes.
Yeah, but every step there was a failure.
Yeah, there was a litany of failure, wasn't it? a litany of failure. Yeah. Now, I know in your work, and I know since this has all happened, that a lot of nurses and doctors do contact you to, you know, either ask questions or but do come to you with areas of concern. So what is it that you would recommend to them? Do you believe the internal processes that are available to escalate issues of concern now are adequate?
Well, I do. And I always recommend to anybody who calls that they go through all the internal processes. Now, we went to the Health Quality Complaints Commission way back then as well, but they wouldn't take a complaint from me because I was a healthcare worker. They would only take it from a member of the public. So I sort of give them a checklist, I guess, of what you do. You know, you have to address things first internally, and then you can contact the ombudsman and so on and so forth. The process of being a whistleblower, and I had to even go look the word up myself, and they kept calling me a whistleblower because I didn't see myself as a whistleblower. But the process of being a whistleblower and going to the media is so destructive to your life and your career and everything that surrounds you that you want to be really sure that that's what you need to do. And I wouldn't say to someone, don't do it, because if you've witnessed a young 16-year-old boy have his leg amputated because the doctor tied off his artery, and you've witnessed all sorts of other things happen because of a doctor's incompetence, you have to act.
It's taken a huge toll. I know that it was horrendously difficult for you through the time. And I remember watching an Australian story that was done regarding the case, you know, after the trial. And you know what happened was horrendous.
Yeah, it was horrendous. And, you know, and then I was criticised then because I continued to talk to the media. And yet for me, the media was my saving grace because they were the ones that protected me. I was protected by the media. I was treated well by the government at the time. But if, say, for instance, if they had wanted to do something to me, the media would not have let them. The media were so supportive, and I still am in contact with a lot of the people from the media and just think that they just did such a good job when other systems fail. But it was not an easy thing to do at all, and it lives on in your life for a long time afterwards.
Tony, based on everything that has happened, and you have a huge nursing history and career. If you're listening to the podcast, make sure you have a look at Tony's bio. I mean, you know, you've done fabulous things in fabulous locations and have had to walk a perilously difficult line because of a ethical dilemma you found yourself in that concerned that was a massive impact on patient safety. What is it that you wish all nurses knew so that they can live their best nursing life?
I think, you know, like I said before, we have to support each other. You know, as I said, so difficult for me. But nurses as a profession, we're not very supportive of each other. You know, we talk about nurses eating their young, and you know, doctors support each other to the nth degree. So why as nurses can't we support each other? I don't know. I wish that nurses as a profession did that better than what we do. You know, when the full facts of what happened with Patel came out, the nurses that didn't support me tried to, you know, support me afterwards. Even then, some of them thought that I brought discredit upon the organisation by doing what I did, because you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't be a whistleblower, and you shouldn't go outside the organisation. It doesn't matter if you're trying to save lives, you shouldn't do it. So I think that we have to change our focus. We have to change our focus to make our patients' safety and to advocate for our patient the most important thing that we do.
I couldn't agree with you more, sister.
Yeah.
Tony, look, thanks for being our guest at the Nursing and Midwifery Emporium podcast today and sharing with us your nursing journey and your thoughts about ethics, patient safety and the role of the nurse. You've been exceptional.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Hello, Nicole. How are you?
I'm good, Sue. How are you?
I'm exceptionally well. Now, Tony's story. God, it's disturbingly sickening, empowering, incredible example of exactly what a registered nurse is all about. But her story is, I just can't quite work out the word because the words that I want to describe it are often negative, but she is a beacon of patient advocacy. It's actually the reason we signed up to nursing. That's why we're registered nurses. Our role is not just an employee contract where we sign up to look after patients. It's a much deeper covenant than that, that patients expect us to advocate for them if they are in trouble and they don't know about it. And Tony did everything that she should have, but bloody hell, it looks like it was incredibly costly for her emotionally and psychologically.
I'm the same as you. When I hear the story, I think to myself, this can't possibly be happening.
Mm.
You can't be hiding patients from a surgeon trying to protect them and then believe that you have protected them because you hid them. I can't understand why no one else was standing up.
The story is so unbelievable that it is unbelievable. Like it is, and it's absolutely 100% true. I mean, it has stood the test of multiple coroner's quests, multiple inquiries. I mean, the world got in the way and Jayant Patel did not serve what is clearly what he should have served. And I can't speak for why, but I see when I've looked it up that he was convicted of 3 counts of manslaughter and 1 of grievous bodily harm and was meant to serve 7 years of imprisonment. But that was overturned on appeal where he agreed to a plea deal where he pled guilty to fraud and the remaining charges were dropped. I find that, you know, I'd have to read more about that, but it seems amazing. But it is a story of unspeakable psychopathy that this individual who had already had a litany of disasters in the United States, in New York and Oregon, found his way to Bundaberg to continue on in his tale of scorched earth destruction on people's lives.
But can you believe, well, I can believe, but this is the result of not checking references.
Yes.
Like, who checked this guy out?
I believe, and I'd have to double check this fact, but there was a book published, I think it was by the Australian journalist Hedley Thomas. He wrote a book about it, did he? Didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, and I think he found out quite a lot about that very fact in that there was, that someone did check it all, you know, later down the page, and he fraudulently precipitated these glowing letters of recommendations, which were all bogus. And he clearly wasn't registered, but someone along the line, quite deep in the story, had checked it and thought, oh, that must be wrong. It's that, you know, and I've talked about it before, that the cognitive biases that we think, someone must have done that. It can't just be me that has found this. You know, someone must know about it and it's a mistake. But there were many an opportunity for him to have not fallen through the cracks. Yet here he was, just untold grief on people's lives. And unfortunately came across the fabulous Tony Hoffman. Unfortunately for him. And fortunately for many, many patients that she saved.
You could tell by her explanation how very difficult and isolating that whole process was for her. Like, she talks about her colleagues who knew what was happening not supporting her.
Yes.
And we see that ourselves, like on far smaller situations. But that must be a very lonely place to find yourself.
This all happened and unfolded in the, you know, 2005. And so now we're 2020. And my observation, and it may be wrong, but in listening to Tony, she sounded very emotional to me 15 years on.
And it obviously took a toll on her personally, took a toll on her career. And I know she lectures in ethics and law at uni, and I know she is the, you know, the go-to person when the media wants to ask something about ethics, or the media wants to, you know, drag out whistleblower legislation or whatever it is. But it would have taken a great toll to work in a situation where your own colleagues know what's going on, but no one's doing anything about it, and you're watching the madness unfold. Like, you'd start to query yourself.
You really would, I think. You really would. And that's the whole premise. We advocate for our patients no matter what it costs us personally, no matter how hard it is. And her story of patient advocacy is beyond what anybody could possibly imagine, what she has gone through. It is absolutely cruel and unusual. But once again, I thank God. I mean, she was a nurse unit manager. So, you know, sometimes more probably so in the private sector than the public, but there's always this little bit of undercurrent. Do we really need a nurse in manager's position? You know, it's more of a HR role or a business role or a accountant role or, you know, lots of different backgrounds. Does it need to be a nurse? And I think Tony's story is, bloody oath, it does need to be a nurse.
I love where you're taking that, Mick. I absolutely agree with you. And so often now you see those manager roles being allocated to business people because healthcare has become a business model or is trying to be, you know, managed on a business model. Whether and you have nurses reporting to non-clinicians, and some people or some places may say, oh, well, your clinical line, you can just report to whoever. But unless you've got an understanding of the clinical significance of the issues that are occurring, it wouldn't happen again. Like that business manager would not have an understanding of what was happening. He would be taken up the same as others were in her story. They didn't understand the clinical ramifications of what was happening. They weren't working on the floor. They weren't hearing it from their other clinicians. They weren't seeing their other clinicians hiding the patient. Like, what did she do? She went to the director of nursing and the director of nursing gave her a book on how to deal with difficult people because she thought it was a personality problem.
That part of the story, and I know there are so many parts of Tony's story that is so much more shocking than the director of nursing and the difficult people book, but that actually made me feel a bit sick when she said that, because there was a moment in time when the trajectory could have been really different for the organisation, for Tony's well-being and for many patients. And instead of being truly heard, she was given, and I imagine quite flippantly, a book about how to manage difficult people. And I thought that was such a moment lost. There was a sliding doors moment there and it went the wrong way.
But that can still happen if your manager is not the person seeing all those clinical related issues.
No.
And the problem was that that director of nursing was so far removed from the floor, the workplace, that she saw it as a non-clinical issue.
It just goes to show, and I bang on a lot about this quite a bit, about how important trust and nursing culture is to patient outcomes. That director of nursing, for whatever reason, didn't trust Tony and what she was saying. Who knows why? Because she felt like couldn't possibly be true and did, you know, wanted to err on the side of it's probably he. And she probably had difficult dealings with Jayant Patel and thought, yeah, no, he's a goat. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he's a raging homicidal psychopath. You know, there is for whatever reason, but, you know, that trust in all levels of that nursing culture from the AIN on the floor to right up to that director of nursing, those little ecosystems don't work if you don't have trust.
No, you're right. The other thing that amazed me was here you had a manager of an intensive care unit identifying her concerns at multiple levels within the organisation. But because the doctor who was doing theoretically fabulous things and cutting the surgical waiting times and doing the stuff that politicians think are wonderful, his commitment to the process was seen as superior to her concern.
Yeah.
And all someone had to do was investigate that.
Yeah.
All someone had to do was get out of their chair and go and ask people.
Yeah.
And absolutely. I mean, that's why she became a whistleblower, as we heard from her story. Like, it's not as though she just left and sought fame.
No.
She went through multiple processes within that organisation to try and get things to happen. And when it didn't happen, the only thing she had left, in her words, were to, you know, to go to Rob Messenger, who was a local politician, and then she gone on to Hedley Thomas. And it was only then when those two people got involved that something was done.
Yeah. So Hedley Thomas wrote an article in The Australian at the time. I think this article is dated 2011. And at that time, Tony says, I don't regret raising concerns about Dr. Patel because patients were dying and I think about them all the time.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking, isn't it?
It is heartbreaking. And to have that level of stress and anxiety, and as you rightfully say, like our role is patient advocacy. Our role is to ensure safety. Our role is to report when things aren't going well.
Yep.
Our role is to have the assessment skills to be able to identify fact from fiction.
Yeah.
And when someone has gone through that whole process, it would just be devastating not to have been believed.
Mm. I see that she's received the Order of Australia Medal.
Yes.
In 2006. And I think that's very special honour for her and well-deserved. And it's an honour that she should have received in so many opportunities for her to have received a lot more. It must have been just a terrible personal journey for her.
Yeah. But as you say, it has taken a toll, and you can hear that in her retelling of the story. If someone would have told me that story, like, you know, I just heard about this nurse that blah, 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 I would think, oh, that can't happen.
That's the thing that I think is really difficult about the story, is that even hearing it in hindsight, and it's been a matter that has passed through many courts, there's no doubt that something very rotten to its core has transpired at the hands of Jayant Patel. And he's pled guilty to a number of charges and was found guilty. Nevertheless, they were quashed. This terrible thing has gone on, and it is beyond belief that that could be real. And yep. So that's the hard part about when you say, when we're just talking about nursing culture and nursing trust, it is a big ask for, if you're in the director of nursing's chair, to come and hear this wild, insane story that cannot, you know, you would have to say that it cannot possibly be the case. Nurses can't possibly be hiding patients. This it just cannot be in, you know, your little old regional centre in Queensland. You know, like, how could this possibly happen? And so you have to err on that side of what if. It's not the first time that, you know, someone like this has walked the earth. It won't be the last.
So that's what we need to learn.
It's exactly what we need to learn, is that somewhere in this country or another, but probably this one, there will be a registered nurse that will approach her manager or a director of nursing and say, this is what I'm observing, and it will be beyond belief. And it is incumbent upon those people just to say, that sounds insane, but I'm going to just do a little bit of work to see, you know, and test that theory and, you know, follow that bouncing ball for a while. Even if they had just done that, who knows where this may have ended.
Well, Nick, let's hope that that's what people do learn and take away from listening to Tony's story.
Exactly.
That they will listen to their colleagues, they will respect their knowledge, and they will, at a minimum, investigate it.
I know. And I love Tony. I know she's a far more experienced registered nurse than I, with lots more experience. And so I don't want to sound patronising, but I feel so proud of her that she went through what she did.
Yes, bless her. Bless her. She's someone that we as professionals should look up to and indeed learn from.
I think so too.
Well, sister, on that sort of happy ending note that we've all learnt something, it's been lovely talking.
See you next week, sister.
Look forward to it. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Nursing and Midwifery Emporium. Make sure you visit us at the website www.nmemporium.com to subscribe to the podcast.
And if you'd like to put someone forward for us to interview, go to the same website and just click on the button.
See you guys.
Take care. Bye.